This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. From Lucy and Ethel to Cagney and Lacey to Buffy, Xena, the Gilmore Girls, and Desperate Housewives, television stories of and for women have blossomed since the early days of television. On the program today, we're going to take a look at the changing screenscape for women on TV. Our guest is Amanda Lotz. She's an assistant professor of communication at the University of Michigan and the author of Redesigning Women, Television After the Network Era. In the early days of television, roles for women were by and large limited to sitcoms and peripheral roles in male-centered dramas. Think Della Street in the Perry Mason series, or dramas where a principal character was partnered with a man, a principal character that was a woman was partnered with a man. Think Mrs. Peel in The Avengers. Well, a good deal has. There are many women-centered dramas on television today, and there are now three cable networks that target their programming to women. Listeners and comments for our guest, Amanda Lotz. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Amanda Lotz's book, Redesigning Women, Television After the Network Era, is published by the University of Illinois Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. 9455. Those are the phone numbers if you'd like to join our discussion this afternoon. Professor Lotz joins us this afternoon from the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Celeste. I'm honored to be with you.
My pleasure to speak with you today. Well, what characterizes a woman or female-centered drama?
I think more than anything, it's important to distinguish them from the female characters in ensembles. We've had very strong characters in those shows for some years. Going with your examples there, think the Joyce Davenport character in Hill Street Blues. And certainly all of the Law and Orders and the CSIs, mm-hmm. all those shows have a number of central female cast members. But what makes a female-centered drama distinct is that the entire show ultimately becomes about that character, so that you have a much greater diversity of stories that develop, because not only do we see that character fulfilling a job in a professional setting, but we also see much more of what goes on in her life when she goes home and the family issues that she deals with. So I'd say that the stories that the female-centered dramas tell are much more encompassing of women's lives than you would get in most other ensemble or workplace set stories.
Yeah. What do you think of The Closer? Where does that fit?
Let's see.
Maybe a hybrid. It's an ensemble, yet it really is about Brenda Lee Johnson.
Yes, I think if it had debuted while I was still working on the book, I'd definitely have included it, because she is the title character and she is the center of the narrative. And certainly all of the stories that I'm looking at are not just about a single female character, but whether it's a set of coworkers or a set of family members that all also have their own storylines throughout the series as well.
Yeah, so. Something that interests me about The Closer is that despite it being really centered around this one character, and who is a woman, this program appeals to an audience that also includes men.
Absolutely, and certainly that's true across the board. The big thing that changed sort of in the mid-1990s that really allowed so many female-centered dramas to begin being developed was the change in the economics of the broadcasting industry. And for so long, the industry wisdom was that men wouldn't watch a show about women. And as we had more and more cable networks and the audience started spreading out across them, it all of a sudden became really good business if you could get quite a bit of that female audience. But by no means did any of these shows draw an exclusively female audience. Depending on whether they aired on cable and sort of the much smaller audiences that you can find a successful show with on cable, or a smaller broadcast network like the WB or UPN that were both about to disappear, or a broadcast network sort of had different dynamics in terms of how broad of an audience they actually had to reach. And you could really see, if you look at the differences in the stories, the techniques that they used to attract a broader audience.
Yeah, and for our listeners who aren't great television watchers, The Closer is on a basic cable channel, TNT, and the star is Kyra Sedgwick. What has the dynamic been between how network has influenced cable, how cable has influenced network in terms of program development?
Well, I think cable really took the first experiments, and it was Lifetime, and Lifetime has not been the most innovative original programmer compared with FX or TNT. But what they did in the late 1990s in terms of first launching these shows, I think, was really important. In late 1998, or that summer, they launched Any Day Now, which still exists, I think, as really one of the most phenomenal of these shows, in that it was centered on a friendship between two women, one African-American and one white, and it was set in both the present and the past. And the past was their 1960s childhood in Birmingham, Alabama, and it told really wrenching stories about racism in both the past and the present. And shortly after Any Day Now launched, Sex and the City came on the air, and the cable wave as it is, on HBO. And there was so much attention, particularly to Sex and the City, and then shortly after Ally McBeal on Fox, that sort of all three of those networks, you know, those, none of them are NBC, CBS, ABC that we'd normally look to as dominant networks. And so the experiments that some of those smaller networks can do, I think, very much led the broadcasters around eventually to recognizing that this was a type of story that they could tell, and that indeed that the male audience was not only interested in seeing programs that starred a male lead.
Yeah. This strategy of narrow casting, are we likely to see more and more of it?
Absolutely. It's an amazing world right now in television. From about the mid-1980s, for basically the last 20 years, we've seen cable really expanding. And what's interesting is, even though we have now, the average home is getting 100 channels, most homes really only watch 19 or 20 of them. But we all have those different favorites, or those default favorites that we go to depending on our interests. And it may be the case that we're not going to continue to have, you know, another 100 cable channels in the next 10, 20 years, but increasingly what we have is more and more on-demand options, mm-hmm. which also allow the audience to very deliberately target their specific interests. So it's not a matter of sitting down and watching whatever is on, but really being able to access when you want it, even where you want it, specific programs. And narrow casting plays very much to that kind of a situation, and is really central to the strategy that would be key in sort of this coming television era.
Yeah. On-demand TV, how do you think the industry will respond?
Well, they certainly are responding at a very fast rate. It was last October with the ABC announcement that they were going to put Desperate Housewives and Lost and a few other shows available on iTunes for people to purchase. And yeah, that was really the start of a revolution that the industry has run with really surprisingly quickly, given how slow they were to move prior to last October. And so now we have a number of networks have promotions for upcoming shows online. Some even have new shows available on Yahoo where you can watch the whole episode. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very much a matter, they understand that audiences want those abilities, that we all have these very busy lives. And if you want to expand the audience, then you need to reach them when they can be reached. And so they're trying to figure out the business models as fast as the technology is developing and we are adopting it.
Yeah, it's interesting now that you can also find your favorite television shows at Blockbuster.
Absolutely, and there's a whole other culture of TV watching that waits for, you know, that whole season to be complete so that you can, you know, watch it at your own pace and probably not without as long of breaks as those of us who tolerate network schedules endure.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned any day now. Now, the way you described it, that sounds to me like a program I might be interested in watching. And I'm wondering if in the future at some point we'll be able to essentially go back into the Lifetime archive with on-demand TV and pull that up for a fee.
Absolutely. I would suspect that would be the case. It starts to get a little tricky in that although we tend to associate programs with networks, in most cases it's the studios who produce the program for the network that actually owns those rights, and it's the studio that typically determines whether it gets put out on DVD or whether or not it has any sort of what would be called syndication sales. So that's how so many of those old shows continue to circulate on cable. But as the network sort of hunger for programming, and I mean, I think the key issue is as well is that we have the technologies that can make a lot available. Having that kind of a back catalog would be really important, and hopefully Lifetime, you know, doesn't forget about some of its earlier programming.
Well, what we've just been discussing here points out that this is all a business, and
absolutely.
The bottom line is where the money is.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in the book Redesigning Women, as you point out, women have always been a primary target for television advertisers. That goes back to soap operas on radio. How was it that advertisers, or was it the advertisers, who woke up to the fact that women were also a large, important part of the audience for prime time television programs?
I think advertisers were aware. There's just sort of, it's in some ways, it's this elaborate game of telephone in terms of how production occurs. And, you know, an advertiser, you know, might acknowledge that they want a female audience, and they can tell that to their media buyer. And that media buyer might tell a network sales executive. And then for that message to get from the network sales executive to the network programming development executive, it starts to get to be a really long chain. And I think certainly the creative forces in Hollywood, you know, there are people who have fantastic ideas and they're committed only to the idea. There are people who are concerned with making a show that's going to make a lot of money. And so I think the big change here in this case came really more from the creative staff's pushing harder on these show, on developing shows that did have these central female characters, and changes on the programming side in the executive suites at the networks willing to take a chance on some of these shows and recognize that, you know, maybe this conventional wisdom about having male-centered shows wasn't necessarily true or wasn't still in vogue. And I think that actually contributed the most to beginning to change things. And then, you know, as we see in any season, whatever is the successful concept, the networks really kind of hold on to that and tend to reproduce it. And now in some cases it leads to derivative programming that's mm-hmm. not particularly interesting. But in the late 1990s, what happened in terms of these female-centered dramas was that they really began to take off in a lot of different directions and actually provide, you know, a number of great hours of television that were artistically sound, really pushing the development of female characters that we hadn't seen before and making the networks money.
Amanda Lotz, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of Redesigning Women, Television After the Network Era. She is a professor of communication at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with a listener now, a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hello.
What can we do for you today?
This may be going a little far afield from your topic, but my favorite show like 15 years ago was 30-something,
mm-hmm.
which had two strong women characters on it. And there was one episode of that I thought was very profound in making a point about how different people interpret the same event. And I've been wanting for 15 or 20 years to get a copy of this show. Do you have any idea how I can do that?
I would check online and see whether or not 30-something's been released on DVD. DVDs have been selling so well that a lot of the studios have gone back and made a lot of these older shows available. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure particularly if 30-something is out there yet. One of the odd things that has been limiting this is clearing the music rights, and if I recall, the show had a lot of popular music in it, mm-hmm. so that might be giving them some trouble. But 30-something is exactly sort of the type of show that women were largely limited to in the 1980s, so it wasn't a show just about the female characters mm-hmm. in those families.
Right.
And so what then happens later on in the 90s is they begin to break out of those ensembles more.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. That would be, perhaps we could talk a little bit about the types of drama here. 30-something would be a family drama, an ensemble drama. And those dramas today where they're female-centered, an example of that would be Judging Amy.
Probably, right. In 30-something, we have really very few family dramas on the air right now. I think Everwood, which just went off the air, which actually told far more stories about men than women. Maybe Gilmore Girls would actually be probably a closer example in that you do have a broader ensemble of characters, but certainly the more female-centered environment that the competitive dynamics allow now.
Yeah. What's your sense of the diversity and the quality of female-centered dramas on television in recent years?
Well, throughout, even though we've had what is arguably a multiplicity in number, I think we've also had a multiplicity of stories about women being told. So that it wasn't, for much of the dramas of the 80s, really, there was this fairly standard story about women in their lives that was being told. It was a story about a woman who was going back to work, and she was struggling with whether or not she should have children or how to balance work and family. And sort of consistently, these narratives tended to, they were really tough on those women and made those choices difficult for them. And in many cases, sort of suggested that, that women shouldn't be in the workforce. And so I think what we start to have more in the 90s is really a all sorts of versions of women balancing issues of work and family or choosing not to have families in a manner that didn't become the dominant story. But they're single and they're having lives and that's fine. And they don't have that nagging mother character always calling, asking when they're going to get married. Within that sort of range of stories about anything from sort of the fantastic, empowered characters of those action dramas such as Buffy the Vampire Slayer to, a far more conventional female judge character as Amy Gray in Judging Amy, there was overwhelmingly a tendency of these characters to be white, for them to really exist in upper middle class, if not upper class worlds, in terms of the way that issues about money and class were not present. Very few of these women were gay. And I think in what might be the biggest surprise in terms of previous feminist scholarship, I actually was concerned about the degree to which these characters were single or divorced and the degree to which we really couldn't seem to be telling stories about women in solid relationships. And I think a lot of that has to do with the history of women's representations and the way that historically they were so overwhelmingly confined to these roles as wives and mothers. And I think there was a lot of concern about whether or not a mother who didn't work could be feminist, or whether a woman who is happily partnered could be feminist or viewed as a strong woman and successful in that manner. So I think that was one of the most surprising things to find sort of over the course of, 20 or 30 of these dramas, the consistency with which characters tended not to be married.
Okay, so we're still working with stereotypes.
in many ways, sort of the exact opposite. We came 180 degrees in some ways. I think it points out the way that these are still difficult negotiations. And I will say that in a number of the shows that debuted as I was finishing the book and that weren't as central in my analyses, shows such as Medium, I think, is actually just a fantastic response to sort of exactly the criticism that I was having. And there we have a woman who is very much involved in her family. I think it's one of the best written married couples on television, and it turned into a very popular show as well. And also since that was since I finished was the premiere of Desperate Housewives, which is a complicated show to discuss in all sorts of ways. But again, a shift away from these professionally driven single female characters.
Yeah. Share with us your thoughts about Desperate Housewives. I've seen a couple. It's a comedic drama. That's how you would describe
probably.
It. Yeah.
I've largely been ambivalent about the show. I was just, when I saw the pilot, I was just amazed by it in terms of, I just didn't think there was any way that it would succeed. And so certainly the cultural phenomenon that it became in its first season was most surprising to me. I think where, in many ways, I think it's reproducing some of the same ambiguities that a show such as Ally McBeal did. And I think that comes from its status as that comedic drama, in that I think its tone is very uncertain, much more uncertain than actually I think Ally McBeal was. And it's really not clear whether we're supposed to be identifying with the women on Wisteria Lane, whether we're laughing at them and critiquing them. And so I think the way that the tone of the show shifts in very uncertain ways makes it hard to understand really what we're supposed to think about these characters. And it is not clear whether it's a satire or whether it's more straight up comedy. And so that, I think, is where my ambivalence comes from.
That ambiguity that you see, do you think that that is getting at, and with Ally McBeal as well, we're at a moment where we're not quite sure, maybe we're having a little identity crisis.
Absolutely. And I think Ally McBeal embodied that more so, in the sense that with Ally McBeal, we also, I think, had the beginning of a generational shift. And with the characters in Desperate Housewives being a little older, I think they're actually going back in some ways. And so Ally McBeal, as the young, or the youthfulness, there we go, of Ally McBeal, really led us to, for the first time, consider a female character who was coming of age after the gains of second wave feminism. And the way that we could attribute then to a character's worldview a very different set of expectations than characters who had come before her, who would have had, we would have, you know, were they real people, they would have been much more involved in a pre-feminist era. And so I think Ally McBeal captured that generational tension particularly well.
And what about Sex and the City?
That fits right there as well. I think that those characters are somewhat ambiguously aged. And so Sex and the City is very popular among my students, who I think probably identify them a little younger than a 30 or 40-something audience who might identify them more as their peers. But I think, again, there we saw women who were negotiating this coming of age much more so with the expectation that they wouldn't have limitations on their job and their life because they were women. And I think that story tended to be much more, it was spread out among the multiplicity of characters. I think that's one of the strengths of both Ally McBeal and Sex and the City, is that because they weren't built around a single female character who must embody what it is to be a progressive woman for everyone, they were able to really negotiate those stories in a very sophisticated manner. And I think in a lot of the talk among the women of Sex and the City, in those conversations that they had over brunch, and the fact that they were distinct in their desires for life and love and what they were willing to sacrifice at different points. And I think having those characters negotiate those different desires together actually produced a rich tapestry to reflect sort of many of the contemporary struggles that women face.
And maybe we can go back to one of the earliest programs in this genre, and it was actually a Lifetime program, and it was nice seeing reading about it in Redesigning Women, because I had forgotten a little bit about this program, but at the time it was on, I was very fond of it, The Life and Times of Molly Dodd.
Yes, which actually started on NBC, and again, sort of showing those shifting dynamics, and its audience wasn't big enough for NBC in 1987-88, and so they canceled it, and Lifetime picked it up then and began producing new episodes. I think it's fascinating to go back to some of the cultural conversation in newspapers around the Molly Dodd period, and how many of the assessments of the character are nearly recycled verbatim 10 years later in discussing Ally McBeal in terms of uncertainty about a character who doesn't seem to have it all together, and really uncertain about what that might mean that we would be saying about women in society if this is going to be the central character. But I think again, the generational difference. I think Molly Dodd as probably a late baby boomer, and that was definitely imprinted on her character in a very distinctive way that made her, although clearly a precursor for Ally McBeal, a very different character.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. We have that same kind of tension in a character like Chief Johnson in The Closer.
In one person.
Yeah.
Yes, very much so. Yeah.
Let's talk with some more listeners. Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, Amanda Lotz, author of Redesigning Women Television After the Network Era. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Let's talk with a listener in Champaign. On line one. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to go back to something you were talking about a few minutes ago. I remember a few years ago, whenever Bonnie Hunt had her last primetime sitcom, she made a comment on one of the late-night talk shows that she was the only married working woman or full-time woman who had a full-time job that was on any of the, at least the network shows at the time. And I was just relating it to what you were saying about how it had seemed to go to the opposite extreme of women just working and not having the family life, 180 degrees, I think, is the phrase you use. And it seems to me we still can't seem to get a true feminist perspective, or I think maybe Alice Walker would say a more realistic womanist perspective of women balancing both, you know, not just a job but a professional career and realistically a family, and I wonder if you can comment on that and maybe point out some additional shows. I know Commander in Chief obviously had both family and definitely work concerns, but maybe you could talk about that a little bit, and I'll hang up to hear your response.
Sure.
Great question.
Absolutely. And I'm assuming Bonnie Hunt there was talking about her character on the show and not her real life situation. It gets confusing there sometimes. Sadly, I really don't think I can point you to any other shows that at least have shows built around female characters who are also in stable, partnered relationships, really, of any kind. I think the success of Medium and I think the success of Desperate Housewives has begun to open some doors in terms of acknowledging that it's okay to tell stories about women who are not in relationships in some sort of crisis. But a lot of this also comes back to sort of the genre and, why we tend to have stories about hospital workers and lawyers and police detectives as opposed to college professors, because their lives are just so much more interesting. And certainly disagreement and conflict and crisis make much better drama than happy marriage. That said, I think the pendulum has shifted or is too far at one extreme, and I think there is certainly much more room for an array of stories about happily partnered women.
Well, I've got another listener waiting for us, so we're going to get to that caller in just a moment. But I do want to mention, you know, Cagney and Lacey was such a breakout show, and there we had Lacey.
One of each.
Yeah. Harvey was her husband, if I'm recalling correctly. And they had a rock-solid marriage, and she had a rock-solid career.
Right. And I think there, again, I think part of that was the era, in that Cagney and Lacey was really the first, I would call it the first real drama centered on women, in that so many of the ones that came before, Charlie's Angels, Wonder Woman, The Bionic Woman, and there wasn't nearly as much dramatic content to any of those shows. And so I think certainly the fact that you could partner Cagney and Lacey was important. And at that point, I don't know. I mean, our stories about women were so limited in the early 80s when Cagney and Lacey debuted that I think they even preceded the beginning of the pendulum shift. And I think actually the notion of the single woman as a central character was probably more controversial at the time.
Hmm. Let's take another call now. A listener on campus, line 2, hi.
Hello. I want to stick with the 80s for a minute. I've been watching some DVDs of the old Remington Steele TV show. I can't hear you.
We can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. And I've been surprised, you know, thinking back to what it was like in the 80s, that it was relatively sexually daring, even though she was still dealing with the stereotypes of male dominance and having to, you know, play second fiddle to a figurehead,
right,
and that she had a mother who still thought that the only thing worth doing was getting married and having kids.
Right. Yes, I think there are a number of other shows of that era as well. Moonlighting and Scarecrow and Mr. King come to mind, or Mrs. King, sorry.
Mrs. King, yes.
And I think, you know, chronologically, those shows illustrate the process of negotiation and storytelling. So we can't just center it on a female yet. We're going to have to pair her with a man. And certainly in the case of Mattie Hayes of Moonlighting Laura Steele, is that it?
Laura Holt.
Laura Holt, okay.
Yeah.
In Remington Steele, you did have these fantastically independently minded women at the, you know, playing a key role in those shows. And we have to go through that period of those types of shows being successful before we can move into just a single female character.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. You know, it's interesting, thinking of the 80s, I remember a point in the 80s when CBS did something that was quite interesting. They did counter-programming to Monday Night Football on ABC, and the lineup through the evening, I think, included Scarecrow and Mrs. King. Right. And
I think maybe Designing Women at some point.
Designing Women, Kate Nally, Cagney and Lacey. What a range!
Absolutely, and you know, and here we are in 2006, and there is no longer Monday Night Football, and you know, for the past few seasons, I mean, Monday's been a very competitive night, and you couldn't just counter, or you had to have a much more sophisticated counter-programming strategy than just going after a female audience in general, as was the case then.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, Amanda Lotz, author of Redesigning Women Television After the Network Era, the book published by the University of Illinois Press. Our guest is an assistant professor of communication at the University of Michigan. My name is Celeste Quinn, and we have about 10, 12 minutes left in this portion of the program. Listeners, if you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, give us a phone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, among women, who's watching these programs now, the contemporary female-centered drama? Young, middle-aged, older, working women, women of color?
Well, it's from what we know, it's all over the place. Really specific audience information is not always the easiest to come by unless you are a network. Different shows draw, you know, younger versus older audiences, a lot of times it's sort of as you would expect. So shows with older characters tend to draw slightly older audiences. The television audience in general is not a young audience, and especially with as technologically capable as those, let's say, under the age of 20 are at this point. I think certainly one of the things networks are noting is their inability to draw some of those younger audiences in. So in terms of the audience data that I looked at, I didn't really identify any sort of clear splits based on ethnicity. Largely, it's age that the networks are looking at the most and make the most accessible.
And any information about class?
No.
Interesting. Okay, let's take another call. A listener, I believe, in Indianapolis, line 4. Hi.
Yes, hi. This is Felicia calling from Indianapolis. I just heard the tail end of the comment about the splits by ethnicity, but I wanted her to speak to any information on women of color, especially African-American women. And in particular, you know, current shows like Girlfriends, which is of African-American perspective that parallels Sex in the City. Just, you know, if there are any studies or any information she can speak to on that. Thank you very much. I'll hang up
Absolutely.
And wait for your response.
Sure. Thanks for the call.
Girlfriends is not, it's a good show to bring up. It's not one that I've looked at closely because I classify that much more as a comedy than a drama. I think one of the biggest, I think easily the failing that we can say of this era of much programming about women and all sorts of stories being told about their lives is really the way that it continues to emphasize what it means to be a white woman, or stories specifically about the lives of white characters. Any day now, I would go back to as sort of, you know, certainly a show that gave us an initial sense that maybe this phenomenon would be a little more diverse. And I think the stories told there about the complexity of racism in both the past and the present remain unparalleled by any program, I think, female-centered or not. I think one of the shows, the dramas as of late that a lot of people have talked about in terms of its racial politics is Grey's Anatomy. That's a show that was or is created by and is the primary creator and writer on it is an African-American woman. I think in terms of the way the show is exceptionally popular with audiences, I think in terms of the critical response to it, it deliberately takes what is often called a colorblind approach in terms of it really doesn't raise the issue of race. And it has a number of interracial relationships on it. And certainly there it is impossible not to notice that this is a much more diverse show than we see anywhere else. They just never talk about race, certainly in a manner very different from something like Any Day Now. So as far as depictions, that I think we had, Grey's Anatomy gives us probably the most diversity. In a number of shows, we've had some diversity in terms of what I'd call sidekick characters, but even that's pretty limited. Ghost Whisperer debuted last year on CBS starring Jennifer Love Hewitt with Aisha Taylor as a friend, but I believe they killed her off at the end of last season, so that I know they're creating a new character for that show, but I don't believe it's a character that's going to add any diversity to that cast. We were talking about The Closer earlier, and there is nice diversity in that cast, although, again, the leads are white.
Yeah. Well, there is one officer, though, one of my favorite characters, who's an Asian man. Very interesting character. I'd like to see more of him, which brings me to the question, where are Chinese Americans, Japanese Americans, Korean Americans, they're not on the screen.
Not at all. Although Ming-Na is back this season in the new Fox show Vanish that actually debuted this week. Absolutely. It's so sad. We can sit here and I can list them for you. Gilmore Girls also has used a Korean character throughout its run as the younger Gilmore Girls best friend. And there's even been some racially specific sort of storytelling about her. But again, I think, and this crosses the gender line, there have There's very limited storytelling about women of color. I have to look back at sort of not the current Lifetime original era, but sort of the immediate preceding one. Lifetime, perhaps because it was specifically targeting women, actually did consistently in the late 90s do a much better job with racial diversity. There are two ensemble shows, Strong Medicine, which was a hospital series. One of the two female doctors at the center of that show was a Latina. And I think what was even more interesting about that show is it was set up so that it was about these two women who create this clinic in Philadelphia. It's a women's clinic. One woman handles, you know, very rich women, and the other one, it's a low-income clinic that is subsidized by the hospital. And unlike a lot of medical shows, that show tended to tell the stories of the patients much more than it does the doctors, which I think, you know, is sort of standard in something like ER or Grey's Anatomy. And as a result, because of you had this whole set of stories then being told about low-income women that did really bring stories about the challenges that people without insurance face. And in many cases, there were sort of these parallel stories where you saw the difference in the kind of care that was available to women of different classes and different ethnicities. And I think those were very significant stories. Also in The Division, which was Lifetime's police drama, they had an impressively diversified cast. But both of those shows have completed their runs.
Who's the lovely woman on the cover of your book?
Oh, that you'd have to ask someone at the press. That is a woman that was a model for stock photos, I guess.
Yeah, well, she is, I would guess, Chinese-American. I don't know.
Yeah.
But anyway, just because we were talking about this,
sure.
I had to ask. Let's take another call before we run out of time this afternoon. Listener in Champaign, line one, hi.
Hi. I was very sorry to see Commander-in-Chief go off the air. I wonder, was it just too hot politically and they decided to get rid of it? And it wasn't advertised very much. Would that have helped keep it on?
Oh, Commander-in-Chief is an incredible story in many ways. It's sort of the perfect storm disaster. I don't think it's the hotness of its politics, because I actually think it was fairly subdued. It
not if you were right wing.
Well, yeah, it wasn't that far off of the West Wing, I'd say, though. But the story there was that the man who created and did the first, I think, six episodes, he's the same man, his name's Ron Lurie, he did, is it The Contender? I always forget. It's the film starring Joan Allen in which she becomes president. And he clearly had a great vision for the series. And a lot of times what happens is you have people with great vision, but maybe not as much experience running the day-to-day of television production. And these shows are shot on very tight schedules. And what was happening last fall was that the show was getting behind. Scripts were coming in late. They were going over budget because they were keeping actors late, because they were reshooting. And it was sort of this managerial issue. And it was at that point that he decided to leave the show. And they brought in Stephen Bochco at that point. And anytime you start to have this kind of shakeup at the sort of top creative level, it's just not good. Because really the consistency for series television as a story that's told week after week, that consistency is really crucial. So then you had a set of episodes that were done as Bochco came in, and you know, I think he had a little bit different vision for the show and some of the characters. And I think certainly ABC, you know, didn't quite know what to do with the show and had a lot of other shows on the air, and I think they too mishandled it a little bit. So while it looks like it could be the politics, I think it was just a lot of the creative process that just fell apart in a very unfortunate way for that show.
I want to thank the listener for her question this afternoon. We've got to wrap up now. Last question has to be, for me, are these programs responsible for widening our view of us as human beings, as Americans, and what our potential is individually and collectively?
I would say yes, and I think that's what's particularly important about having so many of these shows. And the way that they do tell different stories, is that it does expand sort of our image of you know, what life can be like, and you know, what kind of issues women face, and the fact that they are struggling in different ways really does add to maybe the things that we think about or the struggles that we see others, you know, go through. And you know, we have many people in our own lives, and certainly those stories are familiar to us, but sometimes one of the things I think television can do is introduce us to people who we might not find in our neighborhood. Certainly that diversity and range of stories could still be pushed much farther, but I think what happens with the female-centered dramas really in the last decade really begins to take us somewhere much farther than we had been previously.
Very good. There we have to leave it. Amanda Lotz, thank you so much for talking
thank
with us this afternoon. Amanda Lotz, author of Redesigning Women Television After the Network Era, the book published by the University of Illinois Press. Our guest this afternoon, Professor Lotz, is an assistant professor of communication at the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor, and she joined us this afternoon from Ann Arbor. And our thanks this afternoon to Roger Sutton, the technical director there in Ann Arbor.